Madhava Kunja Bihari. Jaya Radha Madhava Kunja Bihari. Jaya Gopi Jana Vallabha Girivara Dhari. Jaya Gopi Jana Vallabha Girivara Dhari. Yasoda Nandana Braja Jana Ranjana. Yasoda Nandana Braja Jana Ranjana. Yamuna Tira Vanachari. Yamuna Tira Vanachari. Jaya Radha Madhava Kunja Bihari. Jaya Radha Madhava Kunja Bihari. Jaya Gopi Jana Vallabha Girivara Dhari. Jaya Gopi Jana Vallabha Girivara Dhari. Yasoda Nandana Braja Jana Ranjana. Yasoda Nandana Braja Jana Ranjana. Yamuna Tira Vanachari. Yamuna Tira Vanachari. Jaya Radha Madhava Kunja Bihari. Jaya Radha Madhava Kunja Bihari.
Jaya Om Vishnu Pad Paramahamsa Parivrajaka Acharya Astotarasata Shri Srimad Divine Grace A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai Grantaraj Srimad Bhagavatam Ki Jai. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Narayanam namaskritya naram chaiva narottamam devim sarasvatim vyasam tato jayam mudirayet nashtaprayeshva badreshu nityam bhagavata sevaya bhagavati uttama shloke bhaktir bhavati naishtaki. We're reading today from the Srimad Bhagavatam. Translation and commentary by His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami, Srila Prabhupada. Srila Prabhupada ki. Hopefully this is Canto 3, text, Chapter 20, Text 28. Yeah, I'm actually filling in for somebody who had to cancel at the last moment, so I'm also here a little bit at the last moment. So, text 28. So vardayasya karpanyam. So vardayasya karpanyam. Viviktadyatma darshanaha. Viviktadyatma darshanaha. Vimunjatma tanum goram. Vimunchatma tanum goram. Ityukto vimumochaha. Ityukto vimumochaha. So vardharyasya karpanam. Viviktadyatma darshana. Vimunchatma tanum goram. Ityukto vimumochaha. So vardayasya karpanam. Viviktadyatma darshana. Vimunchatma tanum goram. Ityukto vimumochaha. So vardayasya karpanyam. Viviktadyatma darshanaha. Vimunchatma tanum goram. Ityukto vimumochaha. Ladies. So vardayasya karpanyam. Viviktadyatma darshana. Vimunchatma tanum goram. Ityukto vimumochaha. So vardaryasya karpanam. Viviktadyatma darshana. Vimunchatma tanum goram. Ityukto vimumochaha. Sa, the Supreme Lord, Hari. Avadarya, perceiving. Asya, of Lord Brahma. Karpanyam, the distress. Vivikta, without a doubt. Adhyatma, mind of others. Darshana, one who can see. Vimuncha, cast off. Atmatanum, your body. Goram, impure. Iti ukta, thus commanded. Vimumochaha, Lord Brahma threw it off. Translation, the Lord, who can distinctly see the minds of others, perceived Brahma's distress and said to him, cast off this impure body of yours. Thus commanded by the Lord, Lord Brahma cast off his body. Purport. The Lord is described here by the word viviktadyatma darshana. If anyone can completely perceive another's distress without doubt, it is the Lord himself. If someone is in distress and wants to get relief from his friend, sometimes it so happens that his friend does not appreciate the volume of distress he is suffering. But for the Supreme Lord, it is not difficult. The Supreme Lord, as Paramatma, is sitting within the heart of every living entity, and he directly perceives the exact causes of distress. In Bhagavad Gita, the Lord says, Sarasya chaham tridishani vishta. I'm sitting in everyone's heart, and because of me, one's remembrance and forgetfulness occur. Thus, whenever one fully surrenders unto the Supreme Lord, one finds that he is sitting within one's heart. He can give us direction how to get out of dangers or how to approach him in devotional service. The Lord, however, asked Brahma to give up his present body because it had created the demoniac principle. According to Sridhar Swami, Brahma's constant dropping of his body does not refer to his actually giving up his body. Rather, he suggests that Brahma gave up a particular mentality. Mind is the subtle body of the living entity. We may sometimes be absorbed in some thought which is sinful, but if we give up the sinful thought, it may be said that we give up the body. Brahma's mind was not in correct order when he created the demons. It must have been full of passion, because the entire creation was passionate. Therefore, such passionate sons were born. It follows that any father and mother should also be careful while begetting children. The mental condition of a child depends on the mental status of his parents at the time he is conceived. According to the Vedic system, therefore, the Garbhadana Samskara, or the ceremony for giving birth to a child, is observed. Before begetting a child, one has to sanctify his perplexed mind. When the parents engage their minds in the lotus feet of the Lord, and in such a state the child is born, naturally good devotee children come. When the society is full of good population, there is no trouble from demoniac mentalities. Om Angyana Timirandasya Gananjana Shalakaya Chakshur Unmilitam Yena Tasmai Shri Guruve Namaha Shri Chaitanya Manobishtam Shtapitam Yena Bhutale Svayam Rupa Kadamayam Dadati Sva Padantikam Vanshakalpatarubhyasya Kripa Sindhubhya Epacha Patitanam Pavanebhyo Vaishnavebhyo Namo Namaha Jai Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadhar Srivasari Gaura Bhakta Vrinda Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama Rama Rama, Rama Hare Hare. So welcome everybody, if anybody is here or tuning in online from out of town, in town for the Festival of the Holy Name, welcome to Alachua. We're kicking off a week of celebrating, extra celebrating the Holy Name, and for that reason, I was asked, as were all of the speakers who will be giving class in the lead-up and during the festival, to focus the class on the Holy Name, which I will do after some minutes of introductory material. So I want to comment, it's nice to give class to a not mixed audience, although the temple room does feel a little bit empty without 100 children sitting in here when I normally give class. But we are continuing today with the third canto of the Bhagavatam, and we are still in the conversations of between Vidura and Maitreya, and we're getting deeper and deeper and deeper into this. This chapter began with the conclusion of the pastimes of Varaha Dev, and in an effort to keep the narrative going or to keep the conversation going, Vidura asked Maitreya to come back to the creation. So we understand that Vidura had actually originally asked Maitreya about the creation, and Vidura was having conversations with Uddhava, who is the most eminently qualified devotee, the cousin of Krishna. He had achieved the liberation that gave him the same bodily features as Krishna, so he looked like Krishna. And Uddhava was a very intimate devotee of Lord Krishna, so much so that Krishna sent Uddhava to Vrindavan to console the gopis after Krishna sort of unceremoniously left them, literally unceremoniously left them. He just left without any ceremonies. But he and Uddhava returned to Vrindavan to basically find the gopis unconsolable. And anyway, Vidura began his pilgrimage. Vidura, as we recall, left the court of the Kauravas in something of what we call a tizzy, as the kids would call today. He was crashing out a little bit. Somebody insulted his mom, and he's like, I've had it with these Kauravas, I'm leaving. And he left, and then he met Uddhava, and he had some exchanges with Uddhava. And the line of questioning that Vidura was asking Uddhava started going more and more into these realms of Sankhya, which is one of the six schools of Hindu thought. So Hinduism in the modern world is defined by six philosophical schools, one of which is Sankhya. Sankhya, there are six philosophical schools called the Sat Darshan in Hinduism. And of course, we as devotees are not Hindus. We are devotees of the Lord, which is beyond material designation. But in these six schools, they come kind of in partners. So Sankhya, which is an analytical understanding of the material world, very much like science, is combined with yoga. Because through an analytical understanding of the material world, we can understand that we are quite entangled in material nature. And the process for becoming untangled from material nature is called yoga. And so Sankhya and yoga go hand in hand. And as Vidura started asking Uddhava deeper and deeper questions along these lines, Uddhava recommended to Vidura that he go ask Maitreya these questions. And we don't need to talk about why that is now. But so he did. He went out and he sought Maitreya up in the mountains in the Himalayas where all the great sages live, in the mountains where it's peaceful and cool. There are nice big forests. And he began to inquire about from Maitreya along the lines of creation. And in his narrating the process of material creation to Vidura, Maitreya got a little sidetracked with the story of Varahadev. So he went off on a little bit of a tangent. But as all good narrations in the Bhagavatam do, he finally came back to where he started. And now Vidura is continuing the line of questions about the creation. And he specifically asked Maitreya at the beginning of the chapter about how the Prajapatis evolved the material creation after they were created by Lord Brahma. And it's interesting that in the first 20 or so verses of this chapter, Srila Prabhupada mentions in the translation of the verses the word evolve four or five times. He asked how the Prajapatis evolved the creation. He asked how the manifested universe itself evolved. He asked about the evolution of the Mahatattva, which I'll come to in a moment, and he asked about evolution of five sets of five. There's a reference in an earlier verse, I think it's verse 12 or 13 in this chapter, about evolving sets of five. And I thought it was interesting thinking along the lines of Sankhya and science and the work that we do with the Bhaktivedanta Institute about evolution. We know that evolution, when Srila Prabhupada was manifesting his pastimes on this earth, especially towards the end of his manifested pastimes on the earth, evolution was quite a hot topic, one could say. There was a whole series of morning walks that Srila Prabhupada gave in which he was debating the topic of evolution with some of his leading devotees and leading scientist devotees, and he really gave the Bhaktivedanta Institute the mandate of proving this principle that life does not come from matter, but life comes from life. And of course, from the scientific perspective, the question of how life evolves is a very different question than the question of how life began. So this is a big topic. I don't mean to unpack this entire topic like such, only to mention that Prabhupada does use the word evolve in an affirmative sense, in a confirmative sense. The Prabhupada is acknowledging here in his translation of these verses that things in the material universe do evolve. And in fact, in the first 20 or so verses of this chapter, the process of the evolution of material energy is quite clearly laid out. Material energy begins with what's called pradana. Pradana or pradana, I don't know how to pronounce it properly. You can pretend I pronounce it properly. Pradana is unmanifested material energy. And even modern scientists accept that material energy is sometimes manifested and sometimes not manifested, although they might not know all of the details. When pradana begins its first manifestation, it manifests as the Mahatattva, which is the first concrete appearance of material energy. Before the Mahatattva, all of material energy is in an undifferentiated state. And this is also, again, this is also recognized by modern scientists. When modern scientists delineate the Big Bang Theory, the Big Bang Theory begins with what's called the unification epoch, which is when all mundane forces are unified as one and nothing is manifested. Right after that, in an instant, in what the scientists will define as 10 to the negative 29 seconds, which is a zero with a decimal point and 28 zeros and a one at the end of it, seconds, the material universe expands rapidly. And this is the manifestation of the Mahatattva. As this chapter of the Bhagavatam explains, the living entities enter into the Mahatattva, and by their own destiny, the Mahatattva begins to evolve in all kinds of different ways. And that's the first use of the word evolution that Prabhupada uses here. And what does it mean by their destinies? Is that the living entities come into the universe carrying all of the karma that they had at the end of the last universe. Maitreya tells Vidura here that at this time, Lord Brahma, with the help of the Supreme Lord Vishnu, begins to manifest the universe as it was before. And so there's an acknowledgement of a cyclical appearance and disappearance of the entire universes, of many, many material universes. And so the living entities enter into the universe, and under the direction of Lord Brahma, they begin to evolve all kinds of combinations of five, as this chapter says. The first combination of five, Prabhupada describes as elemental, and they are, in fact, the five gross material elements: earth, air, water, fire, and ether. Ether is the first manifestation of material energy, and that ether is a word that has kind of gone out of favor in the modern usage, but it really refers to space. So the first material element that manifests is space. And this is entirely in line with what modern scientists say about the creation of the universe. From the Pradhana manifests the Mahatattva, that's what the Bhagavatam says, and what the modern scientists say is that from undifferentiated, unified material energy, the universe rapidly expands as space. And we know that anybody who's ever sprayed a can of compressed air on their computer to get rid of all the dust or whatever, they know that the longer you spray the can, the colder the can gets. And that's because the gas that was compressed within the can is expanding. And as things expand, they cool down. This is a fundamental principle of thermodynamics. And so as the space expanded, it began to cool down, and it cooled down to the point where tangible, or what's called friable matter, condensed into atoms. And the Bhagavatam confirms this too. After the manifestation of space, condensed out of space, air, which is, you can touch, air is made of atoms. That's why when the wind blows, I can feel it against my skin. Right now, there are approximately 14 pounds of air on every square inch of your body. And you can tell that, not directly here, but if you were to go up to the top of the mountain, suddenly you wouldn't be able to breathe as well, but you'd be able to jump a little higher because there's not as much air pushing you down. I was gonna give a mundane example there, but I won't. And then so air, now we have molecules which have mass. Under the force of gravity, which is one of the energies that separated out of the original unification of the Pradhana, these molecules start to accumulate in bigger and bigger and bigger groups under more and more pressure with more and more energy until stars ignite. And then we get the third material element, which is fire, right? And the sky lights up. And it's interesting that in the Bhagavatam also, in the beginning of Lord Brahma's life, there was no light. The light didn't appear into the universe until some stages of evolution later. And then we know that in the furnace of stars, all other heavier elements can be made, including oxygen, which combining with hydrogen creates water, and then all of the other heavier elements like silicon, which make up the earth, and so on and so forth. So there's an evolution from subtle elements to gross elements, and this is one of the sets of five that Maitreya is describing to Vidura as evolving out of the creation of the universe. Accompanying these five material elements are the subtle forms of these elements, which are called tanmatras. Tanmatras, so space has a subtle form, which is sound. Air has a subtle form, which is touch. Fire has a subtle form, which is light. Water has a subtle form, which is taste. And earth has a subtle form, which is smell, right? And so these are the five tanmatras, which are associated with the material elements. And how do we know this? We know this because we have knowledge-acquiring senses that are attuned to each one of these elements and their subtle forms. We have ears that can hear the tanmatra of sound, which is manifested in space. We have skin, which is a knowledge-acquiring sense, which can touch the air. And so we have an element, we have a tanmatra, and we have the sense perception of those things through a sense organ, skin. With our eyes, we can see light, fire, and so on and so forth. With our tongue, we can taste water, which is the, and its subtle form, taste. Taste is a subtle form. And then with our nose, we can perceive the subtle form of earth, which is smell. And so that's the third set of five things that have evolved out of the living entity's contact with the mahatattva, material energy. And so now we've gone from this gross, we've gone from undifferentiated material energy to a manifestation of perceivable material energy to all of the different kinds of perception within the material world. Hearing, touching, seeing, smelling, tasting. I got that a little out of order, but you get the gist of it. And then finally, having perception of the material world, we are able to manipulate the material world with our senses of action, or our working senses, our arms, our legs, our tongue for speaking. So the tongue, or I could say the mouth for speaking, which is different than the tongue for tasting, and then the genitals for procreating, and the rectum for evacuating. These are the working senses in the material world, and it's through these five working senses that we are able to manipulate material energy. And all of this evolved out of the mahatattva when the living entity, with its destinies, came in contact with it. In the current verse, we are hearing about how Lord Brahma became entangled in all of this mess. Right? It said first, these are four sets of five. There's a fifth set of five, which Lord Brahma became entangled with. And these are the various coverings of ignorance in the material world. The first one is tamisra, which is anger. You know, we get upset because we try to manipulate material energy and it just doesn't work. I try to keep my apartment cool and then the air conditioning fails. He's laughing because he's responsible for the air conditioning. So now I'm mad. My shoes are wet. I'm not really that mad about it. But we get mad when we don't get what we want in the material world, right? And so this is called tamisra. This is one of the coverings of ignorance in the material world, tamisra. There's anda tamisra, which is the false understanding that death is the end. That I'm going to live this life, I'm going to die, and that's the end of it. Ashes to ashes, dust to dust. My consciousness is simply a creation of a mature combination of material elements, and that when that combination runs its course, when the material elements in my body are no longer interacting properly with each other, the body is just going to die and return to the earth and the material elements from which it came, and the I here, that's just the end of it. This is called anda tamisra. This is a covering of ignorance in the material world. There's ignorance itself, tama, which is to accept something for that which it is not, right? The common example that's given in Vedanta philosophy is to see a rope as a snake. So we're wandering around here in the dark and there's a rope, sometimes this happens to me over at the school when I come in the morning and it's still dark and there's a garden hose that hasn't been put away properly, and there's a garden hose there, and I think it's a snake. It's a snake. There was another time we had a family of skunks that made their home under our kindergarten, and I saw a baby skunk there one morning, and it was dark. And there's a black cat, Sham, who likes to roam around our school. We planted him a little garden of cat grass and catnip, so he stays out of the herb garden. which didn't work. He still likes to hang out in the herb garden because that's where the people come and pet him. But Shyam is this little black cat that wanders around the school. And one time, and Shyam is terrified of me, I'm not going to lie. I did that deliberately because Shyam sometimes likes to come in the building if we leave the door open. And Shyam, being a cat, will probably pee in the building. And we don't want that. So I've made it so Shyam is a little bit afraid of me. And one morning I was walking there and there was this black mammal, this little black mammal there. And I thought it was Shyam. And I went up to say good morning to Shyam, but it actually wasn't Shyam. It was a baby skunk. And I backed up. Like, oh, sorry. So that's ignorance. Ignorance is mistaking something to be what it is not. And this is a covering of the living entity in the material world. There's also moha. Moha is illusion. So it's one thing to not know what something is. That's ignorance. It's another thing to accept something for what it is not, right? So we might not know, I don't want to wade into that controversy. So sometimes we don't know what something is, but because we are possessed of a cheating mentality, we will make it up anyway, right? That's called moha, illusion, being illusion. So, I use this example sometimes with my work with the BI and also in teaching middle school science, that if you go to the shore of the ocean and look out across the horizon, it will appear as though the horizon is flat, for sure. And everybody's done this. We've all been to the beach for Rath Yatra or whatever, nice Saturday vacation. If we look out across the horizon, the earth will appear flat. But we don't know, right? It's too big to know. We don't know what's on the other side of the ocean. But then to claim that the earth is flat just based on that one observation is illusion. Because if you watch something sail over that horizon, your perception will change and it will reveal other things. And then if you go up to a high point, a lighthouse or whatever, and watch that same object sail over the horizon, your perception will also change again. And then through added perception, it will become revealed to us that actually these things aren't falling off a cliff. And it's not that if I grab a telescope, I'll just be able to see it continually sailing and sailing and sailing off to the horizon. It will eventually disappear behind the horizon because the Earth is in fact a globe. And this is confirmed throughout the Vedic scriptures as well. I have 15 pages of quotes from Srila Prabhupada and other Vaishnavacharyas confirming that the Earth is a globe if you aren't open to taking the modern scientific perspective of it, which is fair enough. So this is an illusion. This is not only not knowing what something is, this is claiming that something isn't what it is. So this is another form of covering in the material world, illusion. And then finally, the fifth covering, this we're talking about evolving sets of five here. The fifth covering is, is Mahatama or Mahamoha. This is a great illusion. And Prabhupada translates this as being driven mad by the actions and the entanglement of the material world. And we see that people are completely mad in this world. Prabhupada commented once that he was flying, I think, from Boston to New York or from New York to Boston, which is like a 45-minute plane flight, right? But he was commenting it's a 45-minute plane flight to fly from between these two cities, which are like 200 miles apart. But it takes 3 hours to get to the airport, right? You know, people in an agrarian society, they would never leave home. There was no need to leave home. They had a little plot of land. They were self-sufficient. They could grow whatever they needed. And if they needed something that they didn't have, they could go to one of their neighbors. And there was no need to go anywhere. Nowadays, you know, people are commuting. I mean, I used to live in Gainesville, right? And I would commute out here every day for work. That's 15 miles. You know, before the invention of the automobile, that would be as far as you could travel in a day, right? You have a horse, you can maybe go 15 miles in a day in a carriage, maybe 20, maybe 30 miles, depending on the quality of the horse. But this is madness, actually, that we've invented these machines. Prabhupada said dogs are running around on four legs, humans are running around on four wheels. This is actually madness, This is actually madness. If we look at the construction of these engines and the energy it takes to make these engines and the energies that the energy that these engines consume to get from Gainesville to Alachua, the whole society has gone mad out of a desire to enjoy material energy. And we see that this is happening not only for us little living entities in these contaminated human bodies, but this is also happening to the great Lord Brahma, who when he first became involved in the creation of the material universe, was afflicted by all of these coverings. And he repeatedly threw off his body, as the Bhagavatam explains. So the episode of him throwing off this body, Krishna saying, cast off this impure body, this is the third time in the last 28 verses that Lord Brahma's had to cast off his body. And the commentary here from Sridhar Swami is that this doesn't mean that he was giving up his life. The giving up of the life of Lord Brahma is accompanied by a great universal devastation, right? He's casting off his passionate and ignorant mentality. He's casting off his subtle body, which Prabhupada here is describing as his mind. And Lord Brahma was able to do that. He was like, okay. In this particular episode, so he created a host of different demigods, and then he created some demons. And the demons, you know, they wanted to enjoy material energy with Lord Brahma. And at first, Lord Brahma, being less graphic than the Bhagavatam is about this, they wanted to sleep with him, his kids. That's what the Bhagavatam describes. That was in a couple of verses previously. And at first when this happened, Lord Brahma was a little bit amused by this. He was like, what? That's kind of weird. But then he was like fully creeped out. He's like, oh my God, they're after me. And so he ran and he took shelter of the Lord, which is really the lesson here. In all of the afflictions, so we see the afflictions of the material world, and at first we kind of think, this is a little bit laughable. I mean, sometimes we're able to laugh at ourselves. How crazy am I? Ha, 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 ha. But then when we really analyze how crazy am I, it's like, oh God, this is actually really bad. This is really bad. The number of minutes in a day that I'm forgetting Krishna versus the number of minutes in the day that I'm remembering Krishna is not a laughing matter. It's not a laughing matter. It's a very serious matter, actually. And Lord Brahma did the only sane thing that somebody can do in this world, which is to take shelter of Lord Krishna. He ran and he hid behind Lord Krishna and he said, Krishna, help, these people are after me. And Krishna said, cast off this impure body of yours. And Lord Brahma, being the most empowered being in this universe, was able to just cast it off. He was like, okay. Now we are confronted with the same thing. We are constantly smitten, attacked by our enemies in the form of lust and anger and greed and madness and illusion and envy. These are the demoniac mentalities of the living entity that we're constantly under attack by. But we are not able to just cast off our bodies like Lord Brahma was. You know, so many times something is occupying our mind and we might reveal our mind to a friend and they're just like, just don't think about it, right? Just don't think about it. But how hard is that, right, to just not think about it? Even Prabhupada here is writing that the only person that can really understand deeply all of our sufferings and distresses is Krishna. How many times do we have the experience that we reveal our minds to a dear friend, and the dear friend just starts talking about the same time, the time that they had that same feeling? Oh yeah, I can relate, that happened to me once, and then they just start talking about themselves, right? Well, let me tell you how I experienced that once, and the empathy and the compassion is just like, at cross purposes with each other, we can say. So Lord Krishna is really the only friend of the living entity in the material world. That's just a little bit of a side point. But the point is that we are not empowered like Lord Brahma, and we are not able to just cast off our material conceptions of life. We're not able to just change our subtle body, right? The subtle body is so our gross body is made of earth, air, water, fire, and ether. Our subtle body is made of mind, intelligence, and false ego. And this identification with the subtle body is so gross that they're so great or so powerful that people, when they want to reveal their minds, they think it's their mind, right? My mind is driving me crazy. But it's actually not our mind. Mind is a material element that we are identifying with. just like the earth that's in the body. We don't say my earth, right? We don't say my water. It's just the grosser the material element, the least likely we are to have a firm identification with it, right? So as these material elements get more and more subtle, our identification with them becomes stronger and stronger and stronger. So my mind is driving me crazy. That's a function of my intelligence. But intelligence is also just a material element. We are identifying with qualities and degrees of intelligence based on our previous karma. And it's the same thing with the false ego. The false ego is our identification with all of this. And we are not able to just give this up. Right, that's beyond the capability of the human being in Kali Yuga. So what is our option? Our option is that we purify ourselves of these things. And how do we purify ourselves of these things? In Kali Yuga, we purify ourselves of these things by chanting the holy names of the Lord. This is the Yuga Dharma. And this has nothing to do with Hare Krishnas or Jews or Christians or Muslims or Shintos or Confucianism or any of these things. This is the Yuga Dharma for all religions. This is the religion of the age, is to chant the holy names of Krishna. Because Krishna is not different from his name. When Lord Brahma went to run and seek shelter behind Lord Krishna, he could directly approach Lord Krishna, right? He had direct access to the Supreme Lord. Our direct access to the Supreme Lord is through the power of his holy name. He's descended in this world in the form of his name. And so we hear in the Bhagavad Gita, for example, that Krishna appears whenever and wherever there is a decline in religion and a subsequent rise in irreligion, and he does this to annihilate the demons and to elevate the devotees. And people ask, well, there's so much demoniac activity going on in the world today. There's wars, there's theft, there's, you know, government manipulations of all kinds of things. You know, the world is being run by demons, and it's being run by demons, big demons, kind of small big demons, not Hiranyakashipu scale demons, but within our own society demons, and it's being supported by other demons, people possessed of other demoniac mentalities, people who want to enjoy life in the material world independently from Krishna, you know. And so it's a society of cheaters and cheated. And so people ask, well, if this is going on and it's getting worse, right? It's getting worse and worse and worse, in fact. Where is Krishna in all of this? Isn't Krishna supposed to appear and save us from all of this? And Krishna has appeared. He's appeared in the form of his holy name. And we can hide behind Krishna the same way that Lord Brahma hid behind Krishna by unceasingly and with full faith and enthusiasm and patience and determination embrace the chanting of his holy name. That is our really our only salvation in the material world. And we heard last week, I got into a little bit of a, just make this last point here. Last Wednesday I got into a little bit of a discussion with Krishna Abhishek Prabhu about rules and regulations concerning chanting. And yes, it's a fact, there are no rules and regulations behind chanting. You can chant whenever, wherever, however you want, you know. And you don't even need to chant Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Ram, Hare Ram, Ram Ram, Hare Hare. That is the Maha Mantra given to us by Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. But in other cultures and in other languages, they have other names of God. In Islam, which is one of the world's largest religions, the world's second largest religion, the Muslims outnumber us by hundreds of millions of people. They chant what's called the Bismillah. That's like the Muslim Maha Mantra, Bismillah Ir-Rahman Ir-Rahim, which means in the name of Allah, the Almighty, the All-Powerful, like this, the greatest, the All-Powerful. And they chant this. The Jews also chant, much smaller religion, there are far fewer Jews than there are Vaishnavs in the world. But they also chant in every one of their services. They chant a mantra, Yeheshme Rabba Mavorach Le'olam Ulme'amaya, which means, may the name of the Lord be praised forever and ever. And in Christianity, which is the world's largest religion, they say, Our Father, thou art in heaven, hallowed be thy name, right? And so this is permeating everything. And we know from the teachings of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, Nam nam akarhi bahuda nija sarva shaktis tatrapita niyamita smarane nakala, that Every name of Krishna is empowered with all of Krishna's qualities. Krishna is not different from his name. And in that same verse, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu says there are no hard and fast rules for chanting. Right? So anybody can grab a name of Krishna and chant it, and gradually their life will become purified. But this is a battle that we're fighting against Maya, and sometimes gradually might not be good enough. It's like if you're growing a garden, I grew a productive garden for the first time in my life this year. We grew some cabbages and some beets and some roselle flowers and made some jam and sauerkraut and pickled beets and herb-infused oils. But the garden needs to be weeded, right? If I'm watering the garden, I'm also watering the weeds. And depending on the initial state of that garden, sometimes the weeds will overpower the crops that you want, even though you're watering the crops that you want and giving it fertilizer. So we cannot both water the creeper of bhakti in our hearts and water the weeds of our anartas that are growing in the same garden of our heart. And for that reason, there are also rules and regulations for chanting the holy name. We should not knock on Krishna's door and then run away. This is a common prank that young kids like to play. They'll go up to somebody's door, knock on the door, and run away. So the person who comes and opens the door is like, who's knocking at my door? And we do this so many times. We see people chanting japa while socializing, chanting japa while scrolling on their phone, chanting japa while watching YouTube. And this is like knocking on Krishna's door and running away, right? If you're going to chant japa, chant japa. If you need to scroll on your phone, scroll on your phone. There's nothing, you might be scrolling on your phone for a perfectly bona fide reason. But if we're chanting japa, we're chanting japa. That is our association with Krishna. That is knocking on Krishna's door. And Krishna is so eager for us to knock on his door. And he's so disappointed when we knock on his door and run away. He's like, oh, I thought Prachananda Das was going to stay at the door this time. But no, he went off to go socialize with his friends with his bead bag on his hand. So there are also rules and regulations. It's not that you can't chant whenever and wherever and however you like. But if we really want to make rapid advancement in Krishna consciousness, and if we really want to hide behind Krishna in the face of all of the onslaughts of material energy we have to deal with, we have to be very strict about our chanting. We have to be very strict about our chanting, because devotional service is like a razor's edge, Prabhupada described. On the one hand, there's Mayavad, which is the idea that Krishna is not really a person, that whatever personality we attribute with Krishna is a mundane personality, and the actual Krishna has no personality. And on the other side of it is Sahajism, which is the sentimental feeling of love. Right, the feeling of love. But love is not a feeling, love is a verb. Love is an action. And therefore, Prabhupada says in the Nectar of Instruction that Krishna consciousness is not a matter of sentimental speculation or imaginative ecstasy. Its substance is practical activity. And so chanting japa is practical activity. That is a practical activity on our path to salvation. Singing in a kirtan is a practical activity. It's reverberating the sound of the holy name over a wide space. Sankirtan, going out on the streets and chanting loudly so everybody can hear. This is a practical activity. This is purifying the sound vibration of the entire universe. And then there are all kinds of practical activities that go into support these things, right? We need to eat Krishna prasadam. We need to worship the deity so when guests come, there's something to attract not only their ears, but also their eyes. So Krishna consciousness is attracting all of the senses. Krishna is attracting the minds of every living entity throughout the universe. But if it's not done properly, it becomes a matter of sentimental speculation and or imaginative ecstasy. But we don't want that. We want the substance, which is practical activity. So there's a note here saying I should have stopped 6 minutes ago, so I'll stop now. Would anybody like to make a comment or ask a question? Yes, Mother Ragatmika. Here comes the microphone from your dutiful husband.
Oh, thank you, Prabhu, for what you said about the holy name, knocking on Krishna's door, and then we run away. That was your Good. Now, in the purport, Prabhupada says, Brahma's mind was not in correct order when he created the demons. I'm wondering, how is that possible? Didn't he pray, offer prayers to be empowered to create? I mean, what caused him not to be in correct order?
That's a good question. I was listening to a famous science personality, YouTube personality. He's also the director of the Hayden Planetarium of the American Museum of Natural History in New York. So he's a real scientist. He's not just a media personality. And somebody was asking him this question about does he believe in God or does he not believe in God, or what is his relationship with religion and all of this stuff. And he kind of demurred. He didn't answer the question so directly. But he said that typically God is taken to be all good and all powerful. That's kind of like the Judeo-Christian Islamic conception of God, that God is all good and all powerful. But the evidence in the world is that not everything in this world is all good, right? There's a lot of bad things going on in the world. There's famine, there's drought, there's kids dying of cancer, there's all forms of child abuse, domestic abuse, repression, you know, you name it. There's all kinds of horrible things going on in the world. And so that would suggest that either God is not all-powerful, so God is all good but is helpless to stop these things, or God is maybe all-powerful but he's not all good. Like, there's some aspects of God that are not good. And if we accept the philosophy of the Bhagavad, which says that Krishna is janmadyasya yataha, Krishna is the origin of everything, then we also have to accept that Krishna is also the origin of the things that we perceive as not being good. If we are able to perceive these things in the light of Krishna consciousness, knowing that, you know, why are children suffering in this world? You know, and if we, you know, and if we're afflicted by this anda tamisra, if we think that this life is the only life and that at the end, that's the end of it, there's really no explanation for that. But if we accept that all living entities in this world are carrying the burdens of their karma from their last lives, then things start to make more sense. And so when we're able to connect everything with Krishna through Krishna consciousness and through having eyes tinged with the salve of love and through seeing things through the eyes of the Shastra, we can see even Krishna in the midst of badness, of what is perceived as material badness. And that doesn't excuse the perpetrators of crime, right? That doesn't excuse, you know, that's not to say that if a child is suffering, well, that's just their karma, right? That's not the point. The point is that not everything in the material creation is good. There's a lot of badness in the material creation. But this becomes rectified through the process of Krishna consciousness. And so to your question, Lord Brahma was not in right order. He began the process of creation. And the point that I wanted to mention about evolution here is that the bit that scientists miss about evolution is that it's the evolution of consciousness. Without consciousness as a fundamental ingredient in material nature, there's no evolution. There's just dead matter. And so this is where the evolutionary scientists don't know. They're in tamo, they're in ignorance, and they're often also in illusion. They're making stuff up to try to explain what they don't know, but they're wrong. And so consciousness is in here. And even Lord Brahma, even the basically all-powerful, at least within the context of this universe, Lord Brahma, even when he comes in contact with material nature, he gets in trouble, right? He gets mixed up in all kinds of stuff that he doesn't want to get mixed up in. He had his sons and daughters trying to eat him for breakfast. That's what's going on in this chapter. He had his sons trying to copulate with him. That's what's going on in this chapter. And he casts these things off. It's said that the first thing that he cast off was his shadow, right? And his shadow became night. And Prabhupada writes that night is a time of hunger and thirst, right? People want to party at night. They get thirsty and they want to eat. They want to party at night, right? People, Thanksgiving is an exception to this. We have a huge feast in the middle of the day, but then what happens? Everybody's like dead tired for the rest of the day. Like, you know, we see this in cultures that have big meals in the middle of the day. There's always a siesta afterwards, right? There's always shops close from 2 to 5 or whatever. And then they open up again in evening, and again, the energy comes up. In this episode, with, you know, the sons wanting to enjoy Lord Brahma's body, when he cast this body off, it became the boundary between night and day. It became the evening time. And this is when people, you know, want to engage in flirtatious activities. And so even the all-powerful Lord Brahma got mixed up in material energy, and this went badly for him. And that's a cautionary tale, not to get mixed up in material energy. And so the ingredient here is consciousness. When consciousness gets mixed with material energy, things go wrong. And Prabhupada writes in the Bhagavad Gita, what is this consciousness? He said, I'm going to read the quote directly here, which I put in my notes here. What is this consciousness? This consciousness is I am. Then what am I? In a contaminated consciousness, I am means I am the Lord of all I survey. So Lord Brahma was supremely empowered. I mean, I can build a little castle out of Legos, right? I'm building a pyramid out of 2x4s for a festival we're having at the school, and I'm like, look at me, building a pyramid out of 2x4s, yes! Lord Brahma created this entire universe, which is so vast we can't even see the end of it. In contaminated consciousness, I am means I am the Lord of all I survey. I am the enjoyer. The world revolves because every living being thinks that he is the Lord and creator of the material world. So Lord Brahma thinks that he is the Lord and creator of the material world. Material consciousness has two psychic divisions. One is that I am the creator, and the other is that I am the enjoyer. But actually, the Supreme Lord is both the creator and the enjoyer, and the living entity, being part and parcel of the Supreme Lord, is neither the creator nor the enjoyer, but a co-operator. He is the created and the enjoyed. So our job is to be enjoyed by Krishna. That's our role in the creation. And as soon as we lose that mentality and we think, I am the Lord of all I survey, that's when the trouble begins. And Lord Brahma, this pastime with Lord Brahma is really showing that quite clearly. Of course, there's the other famous pastime with Lord Brahma where he stole all of the cowherd boys and was quite embarrassed by all of this. So as soon, and I think the quote that Mother Mukhya read in the beginning about humility is useful. As soon as we become puffed up, problems are going to begin, right? As soon as we become puffed up, problems are going to begin. And therefore, being humble doesn't mean thinking less of oneself. Being humble doesn't mean having low self-esteem. Oh, I'm so fallen. Oh, look at me. I'm so fallen. Being humble means not thinking about yourself at all, but only thinking about how can I serve Krishna in this moment. And if you don't know the answer to that question, how can I serve Krishna in this moment, you can also always be pleasing to Krishna by chanting his name with love and devotion. So that's always available to us. That was a rambling and long answer to your question. Yes, Prabhu.
Hare Krishna, thank you. There was two things, real short. with religion, I was listening to Keshava Maharaj up in Boston. He was debating with one of his students, kind of in an antagonistic way, and he said, well, the Christians say that, you know, we say the same thing. There's only one way to God, you know. And so he kind of explained something. He said, well, in the Maha Mantra, he said, Hare is really kind of a generic way of addressing God. So, you know, he said, so really, you know, if they say Hare Krishna or they say some other Allah or something, you know, it's all advancement. So I like that, you know.
Yeah.
And just one other thing is, when I first got, one of the first books I got was The Teachings of Lord Chaitanya. This was in San Diego. And I remembered that I was really quite astounded by the whole explanation of the three Vishnus, you know, Mahavishnu.
Yeah.
You know, I thought, you know, this was back in days when you would socially take a few mental and half, you know. So I thought, wow, this is really neat. So I've always looked at the, the whole thing about the expansion of creation, you know, or the Big Bang Theory. I was thinking, well, Actually, Mahavishnu is kind of like the Big Bang. You know, it's like he's lying there, and all of a sudden, these little universes are coming out of the body, and as they're expanding, as they're compressed. I always thought of them, they're kind of compressed.
Yeah.
And then they're expanding. So yep. Would that be kind of like a Big Bang type thing? I mean, I don't.
Yeah, I think it absolutely is. I mean, I think the Bhagavatam actually describes the Big Bang quite accurately. Or I should say the Big Bang describes the Bhagavatam quite accurately. There's many things within the Big Bang theory that scientists can't answer. And the Bhagavatam is not a quantitative scientific model. So it's easier to get it right, qualitatively, descriptively. But what we do observe in the universe as far as things expanding and the formation of elements from subtle to gross is what is described in the Bhagavatam. And so there's really no flaw there, or there's really no disagreement there, I would say. The disagreement comes in at the point of the pradhana. So what we know about the Big Bang theory and what we know about the universe from a modern scientific perspective is defined mostly entirely of our observations of light. We can analyze starlight, we can analyze light from distant galaxies, we can see how light behaves under the interactions from different forces across the universe with powerful telescopes, and that informs our understanding of the universe. And this goes back to the beginning of the 20th century, really, with the work of Edwin Hubble and a Catholic priest named George Lemaître, who together, independently from each other, but at around the same time, using the same data, both came up with the idea that the universe is expanding. And the Bhagavatam describes this too. The Bhagavatam describes this on a very different time scale, right? The life of Lord Brahma is 311 trillion years, which is really inconceivable. I mean, we think the age of this earth is inconceivable, but this is, five zeros more at the end of the number inconceivable. So it's hard to argue with that, right? It's beyond the realms of science. But the spiritual science propounded by the Vedanta and by the Bhagavat is not through understanding light, it's through understanding sound. And this is a much subtler element. And Prabhupada comments about this in terms of modern weaponry that, in the Mahabharata, they use sound as a weapon. They would chant a mantra and this would create the effect of a nuclear explosion, but it wasn't just this violent, like, kablowy. It was targeted. If done properly, it was targeted in one localized location. So even modern weaponry is done mostly through light, explosions, fire, although they are evolving some like crowd control techniques that use sound, like they can send subaudible waves that will just like disturb people, like I gotta get out of here, or like really high pitched screams. So this is also a method of torture that people use. Is they'll put them in a jail cell and just play Metallica at full volume unceasingly for days on end. So modern scientists don't quite understand the sound vibrations that underlie the universe. And of course, the fundamental sound vibration is Om Kara, and that can get unpacked in the form of the Maha Mantra. So Prabhupada says that you don't even need to understand the language of the mantra. And the mantra can come in many different languages. Although there is something subtly on a material platform, different about Sanskrit than about English, let's say. If you chant Sanskrit properly, putting the tongue in the proper place in your mouth against the back of your teeth, lips open, lips closed, the roof of the mouth, no tongue, all of the different types of pronunciation of Sanskrit, there's been modern scientific studies about this, also from linguistics and whatnot. This has an effect on one's neurology, right? This actually can realign the neurons in your brain to create more subtle, more pure awareness. It's the same thing with writing cursive or writing Devanagari. And we know that Prabhupada very much wanted kids in Gurukul to learn Sanskrit and to write Devanagari. Because the act of doing this with your fingers, even writing English in cursive, this is wiring subtle connections throughout your brain that typing with your thumbs on a phone won't do. And people don't even type with their thumbs on the phone anymore. They talk to the phone, Siri, blah, blah, blah. And so this is all symptoms of degradation of human society, actually. Even having to write Devanagari is a degradation of the original potency of the human being, which could remember what they heard once and remember it forever. And so that's the power of sound. And so where scientists miss the boat is that they don't understand the subtle nature of sound, and they don't understand how the vibrations that create all this dense matter are not actually vibrations of light, they're vibrations of sound. But as far as what the scientists do say regarding the Big Bang, there's really nothing in the Bhagavatam that contradicts any of that, that I've found, at least. Yeah.
Thank you.
We should probably stop there, yeah. Oh, are we stopping there? Nope. Yeah. What? Okay. Grantaraj Srimad Bhagavatam Ki Jai.